I would ask you, if you would, to turn back to the 27th chapter of the book of Matthew. The text that was read for us this morning, the biblical account of the crucifixion of Christ, is a very familiar story. I cannot remember a time in my life when I didn't know it. One time I went to a class of 3- and 4-year-olds, and I showed them a picture of the cross, and I asked them, "Who is this?" And they answered in unison, "Jesus." To me, the nearly universal knowledge that people have of this ancient story is one very compelling proof of its truth. But there's one thing that amazes me, and that is that so many people know the story of Jesus' death on the cross, and yet so few understand it. Well, you might say, well, how do you know so few understand it? Well, for one thing, I read a poll the other day that showed that in this country, approximately 80% of people express religious convictions about the Bible, about God, and about His Son, Jesus Christ. But on any given Sunday, only about 10% are in any form of worship. No one who truly understands the cross of Jesus would reject the opportunity to worship Him and to participate in this supper to His memory. And so then you're saying only faithful Christians, only those who are in church today understand the cross of Jesus. No, I think that we'd be remiss if we would say that all of those who are in church, even perhaps all of those who are in our assembly this morning, really understand the cross of Jesus. Because there are many who are in church, there are many who are Christians who are apathetic, who are indifferent, who are worldly. No one who truly understands the cross of Jesus would be so willingly and openly disobedient to His will. But if the story of the cross is so familiar, why is it that so few really understand it? Maybe it's because we haven't really looked at the cross, or perhaps we've looked, we just haven't seen. Jesus' life and death were vicarious. He put Himself in our place. As John said, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. When He died, He put Himself in our place by accepting the punishment for our sin. And so this morning, I want to challenge each of us to put ourselves in His place. I want us to try to look at the cross from Jesus' point of view. We are used to looking up at the cross. This morning, I am encouraging us to look down. I want for us to see what Jesus saw, to hear what He heard, to feel what He felt. And if possible, I want for us to think what He thought. In fact, the title for the lesson today, if I were to give it one, would probably be Jesus' Thoughts from the Cross. We've opened our lesson in the middle of the crucifixion account. In verse 35, Matthew concisely records Jesus' impalement on a tree by saying, "Then they crucified Him." The scene is described as taking place on the crest of Golgotha, a hill that was appropriately shaped like a skull. To the right and to the left of Jesus, there are two common criminals. Below, you can still hear the taunts of the people that had been ringing in Jesus' ears all day long. "Hey, you said that you could tear down our Father's great temple and build it again in 3 days. Let us see if you have the power to save yourself." "Yes, you say that you are here to save others." He came to save others, but Himself He cannot save. So if you want to prove that you are the Messiah, if you want to prove that you are the Son of God, then come down from the cross. And then we will believe you. Jesus couldn't be sure, but it sounded as if even the two criminals on either side of Him were joining in the ridicule. You see, the sounds were muffled and indistinct because it had gotten dark, darkest pitch, and it was only noon. The sun should have been standing directly overhead, but instead this cold, eerie darkness had swept over the earth. People were confused. The men of science perhaps were saying that it was an eclipse, but this was not the phase of the moon for an eclipse to take place. Hastily, perhaps torches had been brought in to cast a ghostly shadow on the scene. Jesus could sense a growing feel of nervous anxiety among the people. And so that was the view from the cross as Jesus saw it. But what were Jesus' thoughts? We must realize, first of all, that thinking did not come easily, because at this time Jesus was in great physical agony. The full weight of his body pulled at the gaping holes in his hands and his feet. His back that was raw and bleeding scraped against the splintered wood of the cross. The initial pain eventually settled into a numbness, perhaps even lulling one into acceptance of maybe they could withstand, maybe the pain could be tolerated. But then there was panic because Jesus couldn't breathe. The numbness was turning into paralysis. There was tremendous pressure in the chest as if a great weight had been placed there. The only hope of gaining life-sustaining air was to rise up and breathe in. And the only way that one could do that was to pull the entire weight against the nails in the feet and the nails in the hands. But the muscles were knotted in pain. But when life is hanging in the balance, you do what you must. And so Jesus slowly pulls himself up. He strains for a breath. His chest heaves violently. He once more settles in for a moment of motionless lucidity. And it is in these moments, only in these moments, that Jesus is able to be in touch with his thoughts. But what were his thoughts? What was Jesus thinking as he died on the cross? Well, certainly Jesus was thinking of what he had suffered. If everything seemed like a nightmare, it was perhaps that it had begun at night. Jesus' thoughts turned to his last Passover with his disciples. He looked forward to that quiet time that he was going to be able to spend with them there, observing the Passover. He had wanted one last opportunity to be with them, to assure them of his love and prepare them for the great mission that was ahead of them. Perhaps the man Jesus had even hoped that they would comfort him. But things had not gone as he had hoped. His disciples were still so worldly, so immature. They had actually argued among themselves as to which one of them was the greatest. Their thoughts of self had kept them from even giving the commonest service to one another. Jesus shuddered as he thought of the evil he had seen in the eyes of Judas. He wondered if the others had really realized that before the night was over, he would betray him for the cost of a criminal or a runaway slave. Jesus shook his head sadly as he thought about Peter. Peter always had the best of intentions. He saw himself as being bold and courageous. Maybe Jesus laughed to himself of how Peter had told him, "Lord, we have two swords." Jesus said, "It is enough." When the others were told that they would forsake him, Peter had said, "Lord, I'll never forsake you. The others may stumble because of you, but I never will. And even if I have to die with you, that's what I'll do." But Jesus knew Peter better than he knew himself. That bragging had dissolved in the night. Oh, he had taken a wild swing with the sword, but didn't seem to understand when Jesus told him to put his sword away. But when Judas and the band of soldiers had come for Jesus in the night, he too had run off. And just as Jesus had known that he would, he denied him three times before the cock crew. Perhaps Jesus stopped for a moment to pray for Peter. He told him that he would. He couldn't forget the look of hurt and dismay and loss that he had seen in Peter's face when their eyes had met in the courtyard. He could still hear him weep. Then again, perhaps Jesus rose and grasp for air. Jesus' thoughts then turned to that scene in the courtyard of the high priest's house. Now, Jesus knew the official proceedings of the Sanhedrin, and this was not The hearings of the Sanhedrin could be heard only in the daytime, and only by law in the hewn or house of hewn stone at the temple. 21 or 23 of the 71 members had to be present. Jesus thought about the protection that was built into the law of the Sanhedrin. No case could be heard in only a single day. The results of the judgment could not be passed down on the same day in which it was tried. No witness would be held or would be heard if he did not have proof. The accused was given the first opportunity to prove his innocence. This, by law, was the way that a case was to be heard before the Sanhedrin. But this was not a trial. This was a lynch mob. People were sought who would willingly come and tell lies about Jesus. And when nothing could be substantiated, the high priest had baited him. No one could be asked to speak against himself. Still, he asked Jesus, "Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." As Jesus thought back, he realized that this was the watershed of the entire night, the point of no return. But still, he could not deny God. He could not deny himself nor his mission. And so Jesus answered, "It is as you say." They had what they wanted. They said, "You blaspheme me." In violation of every ethic, every law, they proceeded to blindfold Jesus, to slap him, to spit upon him, saying, "Okay, you're the prophet. You tell us who it was who smote you." Again, Jesus rose and gasped for air. Now the night somehow transformed into dawn and then early day. The mob that held Jesus was stirring in confusion about putting Jesus to death. There were some who said, "We can't do this. If we put Jesus to death, then we will be accused of being murderers. And so this is something the Romans must do." An execution order was what was needed. And they knew that the Romans weren't going to be concerned. They weren't going to hear any charges about their religion. And so they said, "We've got to think politically. Tell Pilate that Jesus is wanting to be king. He is especially touchy about losing his power or Caesar's favor." And so the scene then changes to the praetorium. Pilate was more than a little upset about being disturbed so early during the day. At first, Pilate had laughed at their charges that Jesus wanted to be their king. Jesus certainly didn't appear to be someone who was wanting to be a king. And so he looked at Jesus in the eye and said, "Are you a king?" And he knew that Jesus meant it in some different way when he said, "It is as you say." As Jesus thought back of Pilate, he thought about the complete paradox of the man and the position that he found himself in. Pilate was a cruel man with a hard heart. He didn't really care much about who was hurt or about justice being done. And yet Pilate was obviously troubled. He knew that Jesus stood before him as an innocent man. He was troubled even more by the fact that word came from his wife that she had seen of this in a dream, and she warned him not to harm this innocent man. And so Pilate really wanted to let Jesus go and still keep his political favor with the Jews. Surely the Jews, even though they obviously hated Jesus, would see the comparison between him and a true criminal. Take Barabbas, for example, a known murderer, criminal. Perhaps here was a loophole. Perhaps Pilate could stack the deck. He would announce that one of them could go free. But it had to be either Jesus or Barabbas. Problem solved. Jesus remembered the shock in Pilate's eyes when the crowd had cried out, "Give us Barabbas." And Pilate said, "But you don't understand. What shall I do with Jesus, who is called the Christ?" And they said, crucify him. And Pilate said, why? What has he ever done? And again, they said, crucify him. Here, take him. I'll have him beaten. Won't that appease your hatred? And they cried again, crucify him. And that's when the Jews played their ace. They said, if you don't let him go, then you are no friend of Caesar's. Jesus remembered Pilate mumbling something about being free from the guilt as he washed his hands before the mob. From there, things moved by so quickly. Jesus tried to forget the flogging. After losing so much blood, it may well have been that he fainted to the point where he could neither stand nor walk. We find where the soldiers had taken a fancy robe and had thrown it around him. Someone had woven a wreath of desert thorns into a crown and they had pressed that into his scalp. The soldiers had handed him a reed and bowed before him in mock worship. The trip to the cross was now a blur in Jesus' mind. Perhaps he remembered the man who went ahead of the procession laughing about the sign that he was carrying that declared Jesus to be the King of the Jews. Ah, some king. Again, a guard may have said, get someone, some Jew, to carry this cross so that we might get on with this. And then Jesus saw Simon, confused and afraid, now walking at his side. Most of all, Jesus remembered the faces in the crowd. The hatred, the taunting, the warm spit of a vile woman rolled down his cheek and off his chin. His throat was knotted from dehydration. They offered him drink that in essence was to anesthetize him, to drug him. He said no. He would bear the full burden of the cross. It was almost a relief when they had thrown him to the ground. That was until a soldier fell against the elbow joint of Jesus' outstretched arm, driving that spike through his hand and through his wrist, and then quickly moving to the other side and outstretching the other arm, knee in his elbow again with the other hand. And then the spike was driven through his feet. His ears had rung. The searing pain caused his vision to turn to a flash of white when his cross had been dropped into the ground. And now Jesus hung there. It had been 1 hour, and then two, and then three. The gnawing thirst, the spasms in his arms and across his back, the insects that were anxious to feast upon his flesh. And then Jesus again arose and gasped for air. Yes, I think that we could say that Jesus thought about what he had suffered. But I'm also sure that he thought about why the suffering must be done. In the garden, the agony of knowing what he was about to suffer was great. 3 times he had prayed, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. But 3 times he had known in his heart that God's will must be done. And he knew that his dying was the only possible way that man could have atonement for his sin. Jesus was resolved to that. It had been part of God's plan since before the creation of the world. All of his earthly life, he had rejoiced in his mission. He had come to seek and to save the lost. But certainly, regardless of its divine purpose and design, the cross was indeed a bitter cup to swallow. Jesus kept his mission clearly stamped in his mind. Man's reconciliation to God. Redemption. He knew that Through this act, he could right the destruction that Satan had brought to man by introducing sin in the Garden of Eden. It was love that drew the plan. It was love that compelled Jesus to put one foot in front of the other. It was love that filled his heart even as he looked down at those around him. John says, having loved those who were with him in the world, he loved them until the end. He loved the women who had followed him weeping. And he said to them, don't weep for me. Weep for yourself and your children. He loved the few who even now loyally watched him die. His mother, Mary. Her sister, Salome. Mary of Magdala. His beloved, John. And it was there that he garnered the strength to be able to speak one of seven times from the cross as he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And as he said to John, behold your mother. He gasped from the cross. He loved the thief on the cross. He loved both of the thieves on the cross, but there was one, perhaps, who had come under some teaching about Jesus. Perhaps it was just by observing everything that he saw happening around him, who was persuaded, who was convinced that Jesus was who he had claimed that he was. He had faith. He was penitent. And Jesus told him, today you will be with me in paradise. Jesus loved even those who crucified him. As he looked down on the soldiers, adding insult to injury, as they gambled for the last of his earthly possessions, totally hardened, totally unconcerned about the fact that they were not only putting a man to death, but they were putting God's Son to death. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. The blood that Jesus was shedding was for their sins, as well as it was for yours and mine. As Jesus died on the cross, his heart was filled with love for you and for me. Jesus said, greater love hath no man than this, than a man should lay down his life for his friends. And yet his love was even greater. As Paul writes in Romans 5, verses 8 and 9, it was while we were still sinners that Christ died for us. Jesus took great joy in knowing that God's plan for saving man was nearly complete. And then he rose and gasped for air. As Jesus was dying on the cross, he thought about his eventual triumph. Satan had bound man in Eden. Sin had condemned man to death and to hell. The cross was God's moment of victory, not defeat. Jesus had told his disciples, although I'm sure that he was sure that they did not understand, but that he would rise again on the third day. Soon he would leave this world and its suffering behind. He would stay for a time in paradise, and then he would rise again. His resurrection would be God's divine stamp of approval. When his apostles, when all men saw him defeat not only Satan, but death and the grave, how could they not believe? How could they ever doubt? Knowing the victory was near made it possible for Jesus to hang on. Hebrews 12 and verse 2, we read, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Finally, as Jesus was dying on the cross, he thought of the great cost, the sacrifice that must be made for the redemption of man. He saw his own blood flow from his hands and his head and his feet. He remembered the words of Isaiah, who spoke of the sacrificial lamb, bruised and beaten and broken, sacrificed for the sins of others. Peter would write in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19, For you are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish or spot." At this point, Jesus could have called 10,000 angels. But he was fully persuaded he would see out his mission. He would remain on the cross. And now, fully aware of all that had transpired, feeling the full weight of man's sins upon his shoulders, he felt the horrifying chill of the absence of God. Beginning in verse 46, "And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' Some of those who stood there when they heard that said, 'The man is calling for Elijah.' Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink. The rest said, 'Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come and save him.' And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth quaked and the rocks were split. And the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared unto many. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" They bound the hands of Jesus in the garden where he prayed. They led him through the streets in shame. They spat on the Savior, so pure and free from sin. They said, "Crucify him. He's to blame." Upon his precious head they placed a crown of thorns. They laughed and said, "Behold, the King." They struck him and they cursed him and they mocked his holy name. All alone he suffered everything. When they nailed him to the cross, his mother stood nearby. He said, "Woman, behold thy son." He cried, "I thirst for water," but they gave him none to drink. Then the sinful work of man was done. To the howling mob he yielded. He did not for mercy cry. The cross of shame he took alone. And when he cried, "It's finished," he gave himself to die. Salvation's wondrous plan was done. He could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world and set him free. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he died alone for you and me. The cross, the heart of the gospel, the good news of what God has done for us. This was the price that Jesus paid to purchase our pardon and to save us from sin this morning. Do you really understand it? Are you ready to receive the free gift of God, the salvation of your soul? Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than this, than a man should lay down his life for his friends. And you are my friends if you do, if you keep my commandments." This morning, have you kept Jesus' commandments regarding salvation? Do you believe? Will you repent? Have you been baptized? If not, why not today? This morning, as a Christian, do you fully understand the cross of Jesus? If you do, you'll render your life in service to him who died for you. Jesus said, "Take up your cross now and follow me." This morning, if you need to respond in any way to the cross of Christ, we encourage you to come while together we stand and while we sing.